like that's success. And I think that what I would challenge all of our industry watching is that if you think about what makes you happy, if you think about what you really love about our industry, do that. Even if it's not, even if it might not be, even if you think to yourself, okay, no, well, you know, I'm a sous chef now at a Michelin restaurant and that's great, but what I would really love to do is to be able to bring really awesome food to midwives. Fuck, go do that.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Way Ramen podcast. In today's episode, we sit down with the one and only Mark Noguchi, who is lovingly known here in Hawaii as Chef Gooch. For people outside of Hawaii, which is probably most of you listening, Chef Gooch is the man here. He's one of the faces of the local culinary scene and a true-to-life celebrity chef for all intents and purposes. At one point in his life, Chef Gooch was operating 3 restaurants and a catering business here in Hawaii. He's a graduate of CIA and has worked in some of the top kitchens here in Hawaii. He's also very well known for his love of saimin, Hawaii's local version of ramen, so much so that he even had a TV show here called Saimin Says, which was broadcasted statewide and on all Hawaiian Airlines flights. Currently, Chef Gooch is operating the Pili Group with his wife Amanda, as well as teaching food and aina-based learning at Punahou, the acclaimed private school here on Oahu, which has many famous alumni, including Barack Obama. Gooch is passionate about food and life, and I was so glad he agreed to come on this podcast. Just a heads up, we actually talk very little about ramen or saimin here. It's more of a conversation about life, making difficult decisions, family, and what success means to a chef. But I think it's still an episode you'll enjoy, especially if you're someone who's interested in pursuing a career in the culinary world. So without further ado, here is Chef Gooch. Right on. So thank you so much for coming on. I really do appreciate it. You're like the biggest celebrity chef I think I got on, because I knew
I don't think so because you had Ivan Ramen.
I know, but I've known of you long before Ivan Ramen and Sarah Gavigan and the guys in Japan, you know. So I'm pretty stoked with your son.
Thanks.
Yeah. So
it's a privilege to be on. So I'm all right.
No, thank you. So This podcast, probably majority of the people that listen to it are on the mainland or outside of Hawaii. So how would you describe yourself? Like, how would you introduce yourself today?
Oh, geez. I guess. So my name is Mark Noguchi. And because of my last name Noguchi, when I was a kid, my nickname was Gooch. And then it in college, it went from Gooch to Noguchi. And then that was just what everyone called me for a while. But in the kitchen, I think it was, where was it? I think it was at Ala Moana Hotel, and I was working for Ryan Day and Chef Ryan. We had a couple marks in the kitchen. And, you know, chefs want to be able to chew you out in the least words as possible. And he also wanted to know, we knew who he was talking to. So someone one day just came up to like, "Are you fucking Gooch?" I was like, "Whoa, I haven't heard that in a while." And it stuck. And so that's why people call me Chef Gooch, or now at Punahou, my students call me Uncle Gooch. So I'm a husband. We have 2 daughters, 5 and 6. And our company, Amanda and I, we formed a company called Pili Group. Pili Group was the umbrella group to all our restaurants. And at our peak, we had 3 restaurants and a catering element. It was full steam ahead. And then what I do today is we formed an organization called Chef Hui. There are components of Chef Hui, the demos, the cooking classes, things like that. We've done that for years. But it definitely shined a new light on our capabilities when COVID happened. And we became sort of like food rescue and distribution.
Yeah, I see you and working so super hard.
That's what I do. That's what we do together.
Yeah. Yeah, so people who don't know Chef Gooch, he's like the local celebrity chef in Hawaii. For people outside of Hawaii, they don't know. They might not know, but he's everywhere. Everywhere you look for cooking stuff, you're there for some reason.
You guys are just looking at the same things, man. I'm telling you, I don't know what Ryan's talking about.
Okay, but before we get into like kind of the cooking stuff and the Simon stuff, I want to talk a little bit about the backstory, because I know that hula was like a huge part of your life.
Yeah.
So how did you get into hula? Like, I mean,
so I wanted to dance my entire life. A little backstory for everybody is that I am like a second generation Japanese in Hawaii, which means that my father was the first Noguchi to come to Hawaii. My mother, Eleanor Kazuko Horii, who was from both Manoa and Hilo, whose family was from Manoa and Hilo, was she? She was already, I think, she was a second generation. So, you know, I guess it fluctuates between two and two and a half on what generation I am. And growing up in a pretty traditional Japanese family, you know, to hula was the furthest thing away from my father's list of wishes for me to do. So I couldn't. And growing up in Honolulu, I had a hard time growing up in Honolulu. I just didn't fit in. It was, you know, I always joke about how, like, to grow up a good Japanese boy in Honolulu in town, you know, you gotta be able to play baseball or soccer. I sucked at all those things. But I always enjoyed hanging out with, you know, the boys from like Palolo and Papakolea.
Yeah.
So that kind of got me, you know, I think got me into trouble, even though I was smart enough to know exactly what side to stay on. But I'd rather hang out with those guys. You know, to me, life was always the more real. And when I moved to Hilo, I got to dance. I was in the lineup one day in the water. Just happened to meet another guy who then, in talking, he was mentioning how, oh, he was starting his first day, you know, in for hula. And then I was like, oh, it's interesting, because that day at school, my Hawaiian language teacher had kind of invited me. She was like, oh, because I'd asked her. She's like, you know, if you're serious about it, we're a small family. I had no idea who they were. And little did I know that that night I walked into Halau Ke Kuhi. So Halau Ke Kuhi is the Kanaka'ole family, and their style of dancing is very unique. And it was the beginning of the rest of my life. You know, I never dedicated myself to anything other than like Mark Noguchi. You know what I mean? Up until hula, it was pretty much, you know, all about me. And I think dancing all around the world and playing music, you always get hosted. And I start to notice how people come around, gather on food. If you grew up in Hawaii, you know, you take it for granted. You kind of, you know, when you go to the baby luau's or all the garage parties,
yep,
there's always food. And I know I took it for granted. So to be able to understand that the love of food and the love of gathering around food is universal, that was pretty cool. And I think somehow that has stuck into my head. And I, for a good while, I had thought that hula was going to be it for me for the rest of my life. And I was very fortunate that when I started to wonder if hula was it for me, that someone just out of chat, we just came back from like a 2-year-long tour, and a buddy of mine one day was like, hey, what you been up to? We're talking story. And then he's like, oh, so what's next? And I'm like, I don't know. And I said, you know, Kinoi, like, I don't know if hula is my life. And he was like, it was interesting. He didn't pause. And he was like, oh, you ever thought about cooking? Like, what? And we were at KCC that day for a conference. Okay. He's like, oh, yeah, you ever thought about cooking? I'm like, wow, only dorks go to cookie school. And he's like, no. You know, Hilo has, I mean, Honolulu, where KCC has a culinary program. I'm like, And for some reason, on our lunch break, we said, why not? Or I said, why not? And I went down to the office, and it so happened that Lori Myhart, a counselor, was in. We talked for like 45 minutes. She pushes the application. She's like, you know, Martin Noguchi, she's like, I don't know why, but I have the feeling that this might be good for you. Took the application back to Hilo, thought about it for a week, and was just like, why not? Something told me that, go for it. And that was kind of a big week, because PBS had asked us if they could document us. So there was this, so the week that I decided to go to culinary school, selections for the documentary came out. So I had made the cut for that. And I remember telling Auntie Nalani, when I told like Kuha'o and my friends, They're like, wait, you're going to leave now?
To go culinary school?
Yeah. You know, they're like, why don't you wait till all of my belly's done? I'm like, I don't know. I said, I feel like I have to go now. And if you remind me, there's a story, there's a connection to that story down the line when I decide to leave New York and come back to Hawaii. But I just felt very compelled. And I've kind of learned to listen to my gut. Because when I don't listen to my gut, I get in trouble.
How long did it take you to make that choice? Because I kind of going through like on similar thing where, you know, I've been doing this ukulele thing for 12 years, actually longer, because since high school I've been gigging and playing music and then started this website to teach people how to play ukulele with my friends. And, you know, like you probably feel the same way. Like you love those people that you're dancing with, you know, you love them so much, like your family almost.
Right.
But then there's something inside you. It's like, I don't know if I can keep doing this already. I might want to change. Like how long did it take you to come to the realization, like, oh, I think I need to go in a different direction? Or was it just like instantly got a feeling and you changed right away? Or
no, I remember there was a moment when we were touring in Alaska, and there was, it's not like anything negative, you know, sometimes like, you know, slightly negative things alter the course of your life or alter, you know, your decisions. There was nothing negative about my life at that time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was 23 years old. I got to tour. Lotus, are you going? Okay. Sorry, I'm watching my kids, dude. Everybody, I'm watching my kids. If you hear me, like, look up and yell at someone, that I'm watching my kids. But it was a thought that popped into my head in the middle of a tour. And I kind of paid no mind. But I think I knew that one thing that you should know about Halau Ke Kuhi is you will never become a kumu of Halau Ke Kuhi unless you are a kanakole. It's only passed through bloodlines. So I had made it to Olapa. Olapa is like the professional level, the highest level you can go. And it just kind of started to recur as a thought, like what is next? And then the catalyst was Kinohi, just kind of, so, you know, spitting it out. So I think it was kind of made, meant to be. What I would say, Ryan, is, or for anyone out there, is like, I think it's important to, if you trust yourself, you know, if you're a person of decent moral character, I would say that, you know, your gut instinct has a lot, right, to give. And I think that our gut instinct is also reinforced by just life experiences. So you kind of combine those two. And for myself, what works for me is that, you know, if it pops up into my, you know, my head or my heart more than once, I definitely give it a good thought. But, you know, for like you and your ukulele, Ryan, is, you know, I know that there's a lot of people that know of Ukulele Underground, and it provides a creative outlet for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so having said that, yeah. But at the same time too, Ryan, right, if it's serving other people more than it's serving you, it's worth thinking about, because we can only give so much, right? You know, they have that term like aloha aku, aloha aku, to give aloha. And we often forget, like, aloha mai, to take care of ourselves, to love ourselves. And I think all of us know, everyone here who is listening probably has experienced what happens when we give more of ourselves than we give to ourselves, and things happen, right? We get sick, we get hurt, we don't make the best business decisions or relationship decisions, you know? You know, I think that's important to listen to yourself.
Yeah. It kind of took me like years to kind of come to terms. Like, maybe this isn't what I want to do forever, because for it was my life from high school.
Yeah.
Last year, maybe this year, even still kind of working on trying to transition out, but, you know, I'm still working there. But yeah, it's been nuts. But okay, how did you get from, so you signed up for KCC culinary school there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you went to CIA, right? Like, I've read all these things about
yeah.
you.
Yeah, a friend, you know, I started cooking at 25, which in our kitchen world is pretty old already.
Mm-hmm.
I remembered my first couple of restaurant jobs, you know, all of my sous chefs were way younger than me, you know, even a few of my chefs were younger than me. And so I think what was cool was in the early 2000s, we saw a lot of career changes. I'm not too sure why. I think it maybe was the proliferation of media. You know, social media had just kind of started to gain momentum. Yeah. Cooking and food was really becoming sexy. So you had a lot of people around my age that were making career changes. And what that actually did, though, was you found a lot of people that started it and realized, like, oh, yeah, it's not for me. There's a lot of career changes. I remember meeting, you know, like two astrophysicists, four doctors, you know, a couple architects. And they're like, oh, I just, you know, I love food. And I have a passion. And all those guys are not cooking anymore. And it's not for lack that they couldn't, but I think it's that the popularity of cooking, you don't realize how hard it is until you do it.
Yeah, yeah.
For like a full-time gig more than 2 years. And then you start to have an idea. So, but I love the work. But I did get, you know, I did get more than a few times denied a position because, you know, I've been told like you're too old or you're not serious. I got told that a few times. Oh, you're just a career changer. You go back to your regular life.
Oh, there's like a stigma about that at the time. It's like, right, all these people midlife crisis or third life crisis, right, trying to figure out their next thing.
Exactly. So what I did was I kind of channeled that. And my thought was, okay, I'm serious about this. But I also knew that I had, I kind of had a time frame. In other words, I also was fortunate to have mentors and to also work in a couple kitchens where people weren't happy, you know, mm-hmm. and I've worked with cooks that, you know, I've worked with some cooks that they honestly, if they could choose the easy way out and just drop dead, they would want that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I told myself that I never wanted to be that guy, so I'm going to put everything I have into it, and I'm also going to make myself as uncomfortable as possible.
Yeah.
So the way that I did that was move as far away as I could.
Brad, it's so crazy because I have a very similar story. One of the first times we went out for UU to tour the mainland, we did a show in Eugene, Oregon, and there was another performer there that we saw him in the green room, and he was like, just, you know, head down, like, just fuck, why am I here, kind of like that, you know. Mm. and then right before he went on, he took like a deep breath, like, and he put on this big smile, and he did his whole act. But yeah, it was fake. You could, but from seeing him, the audience had no idea that he was just doing that 10 minutes ago in the green room. Mm-hmm. Come out, walk down, did his like little show thing, smiling, all acting all happy. And, yeah, like, and I told myself, like, then it was like 2009, 2008, like, I never want to be that guy. And so, yeah, when I started to feel like that the last couple of years, like, oh my God, I'm the guy, you know, doing mm-hmm. stuff that I think I feel like trapped, you know, almost. Oh, still there? Oh, yeah, right. Okay.
Sorry, no, we got cut off. That's my wife.
No, nice. So you went to CIA, and how did you get back home to Hawaii? Like, you know, did you plan to just live in New York City and work?
I always knew that I was going to come home. And so I did my best to stay focused during my time. You know, Ryan, I think that I always recognized that while I wasn't old, I was not young either. So I knew that I had a time frame. One of my chefs told me, he said, you know, you better know what you want and you better work hard. He said, because there is a shelf life for line monkeys. And I remember what he meant by that was, as a line cook, you know, being a line cook is like playing a professional sport. You know, uh-huh. It wears on you. So I think you got to focus because, you know, yes, there's some people out there that I know that all they want to be is a line cook for the rest of their life, and that's cool. I didn't. You know, I wanted to know what else there was out there. And I think, I'm sure you've heard before, you know, other people have mentioned that about how they're tired and on my end, I wanted to make the most of it. Mm-hmm. And I also credit Halau Kekui because for some reason as a cook, when people talk about why they're passionate about our industry, what made me passionate about my industry is like meeting people, was people. And it was also for, and what I didn't realize it until much later, but my time with Halal Kekuhi, almost 10 years, set the framework for me on how I looked at ingredients, how I looked at people, how I looked at my place in our community. So I never have, nor will I ever claim that I'm, you know, one of the best in Hawaii. I'm very flattered when people say that, but I think what makes my perspective and my cooking different is that it comes from an Aina-based perspective. And we're real fortunate that in today's day and age, there are a lot more Aina-based chefs. And I'm not just about like Hawaii Aina. You know, we have, his Instagram was like RSF chef or something like that. Mm-hmm. But there's like Native American chefs. There are Maori chefs. There are, you know, Canadian chefs who are cooking their heritage, researching their heritage, and then applying that into our contemporary cooking. That's pretty, you know, that's pretty heavy.
That's pretty cool.
But back then, so many of us were still raised in the old school regime that if you're molded and raised one way in a kitchen, you kind of only know that one way. And I feel fortunate that I started cooking at the end of like that old school era where you get yelled at, you know, you get shit thrown at you.
Yeah. Is it not like that now in kitchens? Or is that what you're telling me? Oh, no, wow. It's a big change.
You know, times have changed. Yeah. I mean, there are still intense kitchens. Mm-hmm. I got some friends that still run some pretty intense kitchens, but you can't, it's just not the same way. You know, it's a different world. And I think honestly, it's for the better.
Yeah, I thrive.
I love the abuse. I'm one of those guys that, you know, you get shit thrown at you to be like, yes. But I can also recognize and respect that we live in a different time. You know, I have seen some really sexist things in my time. Mm. I have seen a lot of things I don't agree with. I've seen people get hurt intentionally. You know, we call those war stories. I like to look at them as reflections as well, because whenever I begin to sort of come unraveled or act like an asshole, I try to remember that, like, what is the way I look at it now is, how do I want my daughters to see me?
Yeah.
That scopes on me a lot on how to act as a leader.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting that you make that point, because I think just in chef, just cooking in general, right? Like, there's people that are brave enough to try to cook to their palate and then to their heritage and to their background. And then there's other people that not necessarily not brave, but they just do what they've learned and they don't want to deviate. Okay,
wait, Brian, real quick, just fast. I want to give her props and I'll leave her alone. But this is the other half of Peely Group and Chef Hui. This is my wife, Amanda. This is Big Boss. So anyway.
She just came home.
Yeah, she just came home. She picked up her car.
Still working hard, huh, you guys?
Yeah, we try to keep each other in check. But yes, we can work till the sun goes up.
Yeah, that's crazy. And then
we got to stop, though. You know, we got to remind ourselves to take a break.
That's what I was going to ask you, too. So, like, how do you balance family life? Because I see you working, and I see Amanda working, too, on Instagram. You guys are busting ass every single day. How do you balance, you guys have two kids and family, like how do you balance that? I have a kid on the way. How do you balance family life and working? And because you probably love what you do too, right? So like, I love what I do. And, but how do you make that balance?
You know, Amanda's from Springfield, Missouri. And, you know, my mother, we just lost my mom because of cancer.
Sorry about that.
So we don't have that grandparent support that we thought we would, or that we had hoped we would. And when our girls were really young, there were many fights, many tears, many, many arguments and discussions about how do we make it work? Is this worth it? And here we are years later, and our girls are, I would like to think that they're resilient. If, you know, maybe for you guys watching, if you haven't noticed yet, my daughters have not come up to me complaining or telling on each other, or, you know, we've been talking for half an hour already. but we just take them everywhere. And I remembered a few times where, you know, we tell our clients like, hey, just to let you know, when you're coming to me, hey, just to let you know, we got our girls with us. And I think we're lucky that we live in the time that we do, because there were a few clients that were like, ooh, like, you know, do they have to, you know, like really? Yeah. And then some of those clients we decide not to work with, uh-huh, because it's like, why would we want, because we work in this sort of whole big picture family community, why would we want to work with a client whose immediate reaction was like, oh, no, 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 adults only, don't bring them. But most of our clients are like, oh, yeah, sure, no problem. And then they quickly saw, like, we bring them with us. And those clients today they remark to us, like, I remember when you guys brought your kids everywhere, you know, hanging on a mat. I have so many pictures of my wife at events or going to a meeting with both kids strapped on her, you know, and to all you working mothers out there, thank you, you know. That's how we do it. We take them everywhere. We don't give them a choice. And granted, they're not teenagers yet, So we don't know how badly we fucked them up, but...
They seem happy, man. Like, I see them in all your videos.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think so. And I'm trying to say all this with as much humility as possible. But at the same time, like, a lot of people ask us, how do we do it? Or when they tell us, like, your kids are so well-behaved, or your family, you guys look so happy. You know, it's like, it's a lot of fucking work. You know, there's like, people don't see the fights, the tears, the sacrifice, the compromises. But then we have moments like this. You know, our girls have come with us to numerous food drives, mask on, they hang out, they'll sit in the back. I mean, you know, bless their heart, they sat in the back of a hot ass car in Campbell Industrial Park for like 3 hours. <You know? laughs> All right, put up the tailgate, you hang a towel, you give them your iPad,
go to work. Yeah.
But I thank them for that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've seen like, they're in a lot of the videos or media that you guys do. Like, your kids are always there, and they're always like,
yeah, they're always there.
You guys are doing a great job. So,
and I look at the girls, for them, not that I want them to be celebrities or movie stars, but doing what we do, I want them to be comfortable. I think my wife and I are in agreement that we want them to be comfortable behind a camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they will be a part of their family business for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, you know, Ryan, you know how, like, you know how we kind of attract the people that we want to hang out with, or you hang out with the people that sort of, not you want to be like, but have the same
energy, same energy,
motivation,
right?
Same energy as
you.
Well, we have a lot of, you know, community activists, farmers, chefs. We have a lot of type A personalities around us. So I would be willing to bet that our daughters are going to be kind of type A.
Yeah. It's good. That's good, though. I'm really good friends with Kellen and Lihao, you know, Kupo'oa. I went to school with Kellen.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I went to school with Kellen, and my claim to fame is I recorded their first demo for them in Lihao's house. Yeah, that they probably don't remember, because I never know what I was doing. I just recorded on my MacBook Pro, but yeah.
Do you have your ukulele?
It's a shame. I don't even have an ukulele in this house.
Oh,
all at the office.
Before we're done, I gotta show you my Ranya Sura.
Okay. But yeah, like, they just had a kid too last year, and they bring their kid every, like, they said, the first 2 weeks, or she was maybe like a couple months old, okay, gotta go tour to California.
Yep.
She went on tour to California with them.
You know, Amanda took Ellie with her to Burma when Ellie was three months old.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And we freaked out my parents, but it was a big event for Amanda. She had to go.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's like, and I was like, she's like, what do you think? I'm like, fuck, babe, give up. Go for it.
Yeah. You guys are doing a good job. I was wondering, because
thanks.
Yeah. I always try to get the tips from the parents that I seem like, man, they're doing a good job. So
I do the same thing.
Yeah.
I ask my friends that have been married for 15, 20 years, how do you do it? You know, I was recently talking with a couple of friends on, like, okay, you know, your kids and drinking. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts? You know, how do you deal with your children when they want to experiment? How do you talk to them? You know, those are very real conversations. And I am, and Amanda and I are not the type of parents that would want to make our children feel like they couldn't be 100% honest with us.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So I respect what you're telling me, Ryan. Like, I think we don't do that enough, especially as like Asians. Our parents kind of, you know, your parents kind of teach you like, you know, you don't share your problems. You know, you never put a bad face out.
Yeah, shame, make shame, no make shame.
Yeah, I know, you shame. The way I look at it was, I think I can do my best to not make my family shame by being honest, right?
Yeah. Because it's more shame if you're not honest and come out later that you fucked up. You know, it's more shame.
Yep.
So.
Yep. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Absolutely.
So you've done all these things. Like you worked, you went to CIA, you came back home, you worked at Town, Chef Mavro. You owned three restaurants at one time. I think now that you're working at Punahou, right? Like you transferred over. And
that was crazy.
I wanted to just ask you, like, what is your definition of success today? Like, you know, you've done all of these things.
I don't know. Because in the traditional definition of success, I think that as people, we kind of define success as like a pinnacle that you've hit. Like, I'm successful now.
Yeah.
You're on your way to being successful. You're gonna be successful when you grow up. I think success is kind of an ongoing, it's like a lifelong journey. You know, Amanda and I, we still rent. We still have to watch our finances. But we love what we do. So I think that's success. I think that's like a life success. We, you know, I think the statistics for married couples that run a successful business and endure more than 10 years of marriage is something like 10%.
Oh, shit. Really, I freaking spill my beer. One second. Really, grab a towel. Yeah. I'll grab a towel. The 10% scared me so much I dropped my beer, bro.
But, like, we're almost at a decade.
Yeah.
No, I don't see the two of us. Beer. I don't. Is that your wife?
Yeah. She's like, what did you do? Give me stink eye. What did you do?
Oh, I get that. I get that every day. So don't worry about it. I think we are in a type of success. You know, during this quarantine, we still had work. Granted, we lost some work, but we still had work. We have been able to meet amazing people even during this time through feeding. I think those are all elements of success.
As far as like a chef,
I believe,
what do chefs consider? Like, you know, you are a chef. Like, a lot of the people that listen to this show are chefs, aspiring chefs. Like, has your definition of success changed as what a chef should consider successful? Because to me, like,
absolutely.
Because for me, like, it was, you know, once you hit, like, you make money and it's like, oh, I'm still not, if that doesn't make you happy, then it's like, is that really successful? Maybe being happy is way more important for be called successful, you know?
Yep. So then how about this? This is to all of the cooks, the industry people that watch this, right? To nobody's fault, not to fault our industry. But the way that most of us were brought up professionally is you work in restaurants, you work your way up to being a chef. Maybe you break off and you open a restaurant. Maybe somebody invests in you. So then you have a restaurant and you start to acquire accolades. No. Then to become more successful, you need to open up more restaurants. And that is what has traditionally defined us as successful chefs.
How many restaurants you have is how successful you are, right?
No, best new chef, get invited to all the food things. What I call bullshit. Now, I don't call bullshit on how we were raised, mind you. Now, please understand, I am not dissing the way that we grew up professionally. Yes.
Am I gonna get the?
Yeah, honey, you gotta hurry up. What?
I can't remember.
Okay, come back when you remember.
Oh,
okay. Or say hi to Uncle Ryan.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi.
That's Frankie. It's my little one.
Is that the older one or the other little one? The younger one?
The little one. Yeah.
You remember those pots that you can
Yeah, no, we're not freezing those. This is part of what makes our family tight. So anyway, I'm not dissing the way they were raised. All I'm saying is that as people in our industry, like, we all want to give. We all want to serve. That's why we love this job. We are service-oriented people. Well, to be able to serve, it's so much greater than four walls. So, and right, like, if you're a chef, you know exactly what I'm talking about, is that you would love to give the time that you have for charity events. And when we give those charity events, yes, it's fun. We get to see the rest of our peers, colleagues, and friends. We usually get to party with them afterwards. But there's also something really fun and fulfilling about seeing how stoked, like when the organizers come and they tell you, thank you for giving your time. We raised X amount of money. It's going to help this amount of people. And we feel good. We feel genuinely good about that. Well, what if you could take that good feeling and parlay that into something that you got to experience all the time and not just under the stress of a restaurant? And especially with this, in this time of COVID, what I've seen is I've seen amazing people do amazing things by thinking outside of the box. I think that where our industry is going to go, what I would like to do, and it is to express to all of you watching that success, our success is not defined by four walls. It's not defined by a tasting menu or magazine covers. Our success is defined by the fact that we have the privilege to fulfill people's lives through food. You know, when COVID happened, people asked us, why did we not open our own kitchen to cook? And it's because Amanda and I realized that the best way that we could serve our community is by helping other organizations that were already doing that work, right? So we leveraged our network, we leveraged our friends, we leveraged our co-producers to be able to provide food ingredients for, you know, community kitchens already cooking. Like, that's success. And I think that what I would challenge all of our industry watching is that if you think about what makes you happy, if you think about what you really love about our industry, do that. Even if you think to yourself, I'm a sous chef now at a Michelin restaurant and that's great, but what I would really love to do is to be able to bring really awesome food to midwives. Fuck, go do that. You know, provide a meal service for midwives who are not leaving the side of their clients, their mothers to be. Figure out how to provide them with meals that they need. You can go do that. You want to be a chef and a farmer? You know what? You can. You know, there's a chef here, Lindsay Ozawa. He was Nobu's right hand, opened up Nobu's Waikiki, helped open up Nobu's Vegas. Like, he's a fucking hammer. He's one of the best cooks that I know in my life, who left all of that, good six figures, left all of that to become a farmer. And not a farmer at some well-established, you know, farm that sold, you know, commodified goods. He became a farmer at a very small little farm called Kako Oivi. And I've never seen Lindsay so happy, you know? Like, you want to do something? Fucking go do it. Don't quit early. I think that, you know, I'm fortunate that my success is rooted in many years of being a line cook. Mm-hmm. You know, so I feel very
you paid
strong
your dues.
That you gotta pay your dues.
Yeah.
Which is also what many of us gripe about as chefs, right? Is that you have this younger generation that they want to move so fast. It's like, no, like you can't even execute a whole service flawlessly, you know? Like, no. So you got to pay your dues. But as you're paying your dues, never forget about what drives you, what fuels your fire, what makes you want to wake up every day and go like, fuck yeah, I'm ready. Never lose sight of that.
That's a good answer, man. Like, I really feel like that's a thing that maybe society and as a general, maybe not just the cooking industry, but culinary industry, but just society in general is missing, that component of happiness is a super important component of success, because I know a lot of, just through like UU and what I've done, like I've met a lot of really, really rich people that are fucking miserable. Like,
yep.
To me, that's not successful, you know? Like you're, mm-hmm. you have all this money.
But they thought it was.
They thought it was. And then now they're kind of stuck, because it's like, oh, they did all these things to get there. And not all of them are cutthroat, you know? A lot of them are really nice people too, but it's just like, you know, there's a cost of that as well that people don't really see.
There's a cost.
Yeah.
And that's what you see though, a lot of these wealthy people, they try to like make amends, so they realize that it's time for them to leave a legacy. Mm-hmm. So they become very, you know, philanthropic.
Yeah.
Which is good.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree with you, Ryan, wholeheartedly, is that, you know, if your idea of success, if your definition of success is still that bottom line, that income, I would challenge you to just double check that. Look, if it is, if money is your thing, so be it, you know. But if it's not, tap into that.
Yeah, some good advice. Because for some people it is. Like for some people, owning 10 restaurants and making a lot of money is what's going to really make them happy.
And that's important.
Yeah.
Right?
Just got to know yourself.
Yeah.
That's kind of
what I appreciate. A good one is, a real quick good example is Roy Yamaguchi. Hmm. You know, like, I call him Papa. He's always treating me like a son. And so I you know, he's like a second dad to me. But, you know, Chef Roy always knew he had his insight and goal and what he wanted to provide for his family. So opening up a chain was the way to go. And I give him credit too, because he didn't lose sight of that, right? And look at him today. He's philanthropic. He's got kids growing up, you know, like he's doing it. So success comes in all shapes or forms.
Yeah. Was the decision to go to Punahou similar, like, as the decision to leave Hula? Like, was it one of those kind of gut check kind of realization kind of things, or was it just?
No, I was scared shit about Punahou. In fact, I am still.
Punahou, for people that are listening that don't know, in Hawaii, it's like kind of like, how would you? It's kind of like the Ivy League high school of Hawaii, right? It's like the best.
Oh, it's just no. Punahou is a private school in Hawaii.
It's the best. A lot of people consider it the best, right? Barack Obama went to Punahou, right? Let's get say that.
We have our president went to Punahou. Yes. That is a claim to fame, as well as Henry Kapono.
Yeah.
But it's a private school. And Amanda and I had both been presenting at Punahou for a few years. To like the AP kids, to environmental sciences, et cetera, to entrepreneurial, you know, the accelerator program. And then one night the principal came up, Emily, and she was like, hey, you really connect with the audience. Did you ever think about being a teacher? And I said, no way. So there's a thread here, right? Because I said the same thing about culinary school. I said, nope. I said, my mom was a teacher. I know a lot of teachers, and I said, and the work that you guys do, I would never consider myself a teacher. You know, like what teachers do is pretty freaking amazing. And she's like, well, no. She said, you know, I think otherwise. And I said, well, Emily, I appreciate it. I am, you know, we have 3 restaurants and 2 kids, and I don't know how I could do that. And she said, well, if you ever change your mind, let me know. Fast forward to 2018, and we were in the middle of everything, and I was miserable. I was an asshole because, one, nobody had mentored me on how to be an inspirational chef in multiple restaurants. 2, I never wanted to be a chef in multiple restaurants. And 3, like, to be honest, Ryan, like, I didn't know how to process my emotions. So I was just angry all the time. And then one day, my mom called. Well, she texted. She goes, hey, will you please call me when you have time? And mom never says, will you please, like that. She'll, you know, she's like, I don't mean to be a bother, but can you call me back? Or I know you're busy. Will you call me back? This is the first time she ever was, like, really, like, please call me. So then I called her. I said, hey, and we're really busy. And I'm like, what's up, mom? And she goes, can you come to the house? I kind of want to talk to you. I said, sure. I said, you know, mom, I said, we're busy today, tomorrow. I said, you know, Saturday, Sunday, we got this. We're going to try rest a little on Sunday. And I think I said something, you know, can I come see you next week? And she said, sure, no problem. It's kind of important. And when she told me it's kind of important, I knew there was something important. So I said, you know what? I said, I'm coming up now. And so I drove to the house and she opens the door. She said, come, and we go right inside. And there's like chairs by the door. She said, come sit down. And I knew what she was going to tell me. And she said, you know, Mark, I said, I've been feeling good. And so I went to the doctor. They did some tests. And she's like, I have pancreatic cancer. And I was like, okay. She was like, we talked a bit more. I went home, told Amanda, you know, and then we went back and talked to her. And she's like, so how long? And it was like 8 weeks.
Oh, man.
And it was just like, what? And, you know, and so mom getting sick prompted the conversation between my wife and I on what was really important. So for all of us in the industry too, this is another reason, like, you have those gut checks, right? You talk about, like we talked earlier about, you know, going from here to now. This is one of those moments where we kind of, my wife and I were talking from here. And then we realized that I really wanted to, like, if I had had my way, I would have, like, closed everything the next day. But my wife was like, no, we're not going to do that. What we're going to do is we're going to ramp down. So we made the decision to close all the restaurants, just pursue catering and see where it goes. We didn't have a plan after that. We did it. I'm scared shitless. But we close the restaurants, just do catering, and all of a sudden we are just as busy, or if not busier, than we were before. And then we realize that we're still not getting very much time with my mother. But thankfully, because of a miracle, they're able to, you know, the tumors shrink and they kind of disappear. And then one night, Amanda was like, hey, have you talked to Puddle? Like, yeah. She was like, you ever thought about it? Yeah. So I sent Emily an email and she was like, yeah, let's get together. And that started this. So at Punahou now, I developed curriculum. So I developed food and Aina-based curriculum. If you don't know Aina is like land. So I'll basically outdoor education. And I try to tie in with other students and teachers, kindergarten through 12th grade, just to sort of make the connections with food and where we come from. And it's been something that I've always loved. If you remember it earlier, food is, to me, is what brings people together. Food, it's very much a direct explanation on why I am like furiously passionate about Simon. But, you know, because that brings us together, it tells a story. And between like Simon and Ulu, like really, Ryan, how freaking cool is that if I could come up with an entire curriculum based off of Simon? Or based off of an emu, like how to make an emu. An emu is a traditional Hawaiian underground oven. But, you know, those are one of those things where in a restaurant, in the course of service, I would think about that. Like, well, what is that? You know, an emu is an underground oven and food comes out really moist and tender because basically you make a fire, you heat up rocks, and then you put, you know, a lot of tea leaf and banana stumps on the rocks to create steam and heat. Put your food down there, cover it, and then let it go overnight, basically like low and slow. But then there's always questions like, why does food come out so tender? Well, if you cover it, what's the actual maximum temperature inside of emu? What is the PSI in emu? And you know, when does it start to dissipate? Yeah, so all of a sudden, these things are coming to me that I've thought about in service that now I can figure out and see if it's a class. You know?
Must be a trip teaching, not to stereotype, but Punahou kids, like emu cooking and frying fish and stuff like that, cleaning fish. And because if you grew up in town, I don't know how much opportunities you have to do this kind of stuff, you know?
I agree, Ryan. Yeah. I think that extends to more than just Punahou students. You know, it's like understanding. Great one. And it was with Punahou students, but I was surprised how many of them actually knew how to clean fish. So, and was it a ninth grade teacher wanted to do some sort of a lesson around invasive species. And we were just about to end last year, it was just about to go into summer. So we did this class on cooking fish. And so we cooked ta'ape, right? Which is an invasive, yeah. Which is an invasive fish. And, you know, in working with invasive species, both as chefs and as I guess conservationists, is like, what is the best way to get rid of an invasive species? Well, make it yummy, right? So that's what we did with ta'ape. So we taught the kids studied in their own class about ta'ape, where it came from, why is it invasive? And then what we did for the last day of school is I taught the kids how to fry fish. I'm like, how many of you are going camping? You know, they raise their hand. I'm like, how many of you know how to raise, you know, clean fish? And what was cool is like actually a handful of them did.
Oh, that's good.
But the other two-thirds didn't. So, you know, we brought those kids up and then we taught the rest of the two-thirds of the kids how to clean fish, you know, and how to fry fish properly. And then the class ended with everybody getting to take some fried fish and point.
Right on. Sounds good. Yeah. But you gave us a good segue to get into Simon finally after 50 minutes of talking on this podcast. But so what is this love for Simon? Where does it come from for you? And Simon, for people that don't know, is like Hawaii's noodle soup, you know, it's like our version of ramen almost. But where does this love of Simon come from?
Well, I mean, I grew up with Simon. My auntie Colleen is cousins with Hamura, the Hamura family.
Oh, no shit.
So when we were growing up, there was always a case of Hamura Simon in our freezer. And so interesting because it was always there, I never appreciated it right till later. But for me, Simon is a very indelible impression in who we are, you know, as people of Hawaii. It is, you know, a combination of, you know, Japanese or Chinese, you know, Chinese noodles, and then, you know, this sort of katsuobushi shrimp stock, which is, you know, has Japanese roots to it. And then plantation era, right? You throw in whatever you get. And saimin is actually a very humble dish. There's green onions. Maybe there's some like sliced, you know, egg omelet. And there's like trust you or spam. And then you can add wonton, and I'm a big fan of wonton. So I grew up with saimin. And fast forward to today, and when ramen really started to take off, you know, mind you, like 12 years ago, the bougiest ramen joint we had in Hawaii was like Ramen Nakamura, you know, which is not even bougie, but it was, you know, it was, you went to Ramen Nakamura for something special. And then ramen started to proliferate, you know, you got David Chang, Momofuku, you know, Ivan, all you guys proliferated. And in Hawaii, you start to see bowls of ramen for like $25, $30.
Yeah, it's freaking nuts.
So going back to this, like fucking kill me. Like ramen is like, you know, ramen is ghetto food. It's street food, you know, but it's street food that, you know, people like Ivan elevated, right? And they took it and they studied it and they made it amazing. So here in Hawaii, people were starting to talk about ramen this and ramen that. But I also knew that growing up, saimin shops were disappearing. And for myself, I always gravitated towards saimin. For any ramen eaters out there, please don't hate me. But when I eat ramen, I don't drink the whole bowl of soup. I know a lot of us do. But for me, it's just too much sodium and calories. And I'm already a fluffy kind of guy. So, and saimin was a little bit cleaner. I also eat with my head. I don't so much as for my palate is like, I don't taste flavor so much as I like taste memories. So for me, saimin is a very intimate. It's really intimate. You know, Amanda, my wife, you know, she thinks I'm crazy. She would never eat saimin with me every day. You know, I'll eat saimin on a 90-degree day. You know, old saimin shops like Palace Saimin, there's no air conditioning. So yep. It's 90 degrees, you know, 80% humidity, and you're sitting down sweating over a bow siren, and it's great. So for me, Simon is that. It's a very emotional connection. It's a connection to who we are and where we came from.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it, you know. And I also love how being a chef makes you think about the dish itself. And while I do scream and shout and rant and rave about keeping things simple and keeping things as it is, you know, I always have a curious side of me. Like, well, what if you could change the ingredients? You could change the dashi a little bit. But at the end of the day, Simon still resonates, right, with this sort of simplistic yet very, very tangible connection to who we are and where we came from.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I never had ramen until I might not have eaten ramen until I was an adult. I just ate Simon, you know, all growing up. And maybe my first bowl of ramen was in my 20s or something.
Uh-huh.
But what is it, in your eyes, what's like the main differences between Simon and ramen?
Oof. I think it's a soup. You know, to me, ramen soup. I mean, no, because, you know, like shio ramen, shoyu ramen, even miso is still pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, like Simon has got to be a pretty clear broth. Please don't get too crazy with the garnishes. You know, to me, when I think of Simon, I think of a clear soup, negi, green onions, maybe egg, gotta have char siu or spam, and some sort of a green veggie.
Yeah, you know.
I like mustard cabbage.
Mustard cabbage, yeah, solid.
What about on Kauai? You know, everyone has heard of Hamura's, but were there any other places that you remembered growing up?
It was always just Hamura. I mean, I think my dad said there was another place. There's another place called Shido's that I've never been to, unfortunately. I don't know why I've never been there. I went there and got the Terry Burger. I didn't get the Simon, but it's there. I never tried it yet, but Hamura's has been like the spot for a long time, as long as I've been alive. But my dad's generation, there was more spots. But they're, like you said, they're all kind of disappearing and dying.
Do you know why Kauai is known? And I've asked many old-timers this. Do you know why? Do you think that Kauai is most known for Simon because of Hamura's?
I think so. I think that's kind of like the why people go. I mean, Hamura's is kind of like become iconic on Kauai. Like you go, yeah. my kid went to preschool right down the street from Hamura's, and like 10 o'clock in the morning, you know, or 11 lunchtime, there's like a line out the door at Hamura's, and it's like super hot middle of summer kind, and everybody's still like lining up. So
still go.
Yeah, but yeah, Hamura's has just been like, it's on Kauai at least, that's kind of like the go-to place. What do you think is your favorite Simon spot in Hawaii? Is it Palace Simon still, or has any place?
Yeah, you know, like Palace Simon is a memory because I grew up with it.
Okay.
And then, you know, Scott and Susan, I've been blessed to become friends with over time. I really like Obachang's wonton. She still makes it, you know, she still makes it really OG and it's a yummy one. So Palace is one of my favorites. You know, but Shige's and Shiro's too, you know, it's, I love for, you know, at Shige's, seeing how Uncle still makes the noodles every day. You know, if you got to see Simon Says, they let us in their kitchen and we got to watch them make noodles. And he's got this, he kneads his noodles with a long PVC pipe.
Oh, that's kind of like
every day.
There's a style of ramen that they do that. I forget what it's called. I had a previous guest that talked about that style, but they use bamboo in Japan, but it's the same kind of idea.
Same kind of more. Yeah. I mean, how cool is that? Like he's a household name. They're a household name. So I would say I do frequent Palace the most, but definitely you got to make a stop. You know, if I'm out that side, you got to stop by and say hi. And here's why I don't have a favorite is the great thing about food is what is my favorite might not be yours.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Because people always ask, like, well, what's your favorite? So, you know, I personally love Palace, Shige's, and Shiro's, and Zippy's. And when I think about it, that's one of the few that pretty much encompasses about a little more than half of all the guys still going.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of favorites is because of where it's located geographically, right? What's convenient.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not the guy anymore. Like, I don't have the time to drive 45 minutes, you know, just to grab lunch. And so you do things out of convenience. I'm lucky that, like, Palestine Min for me is not just convenient, but has a very strong memory attached to it. Yeah. You know, right around the corner from Palace is Helena, Hawaiian food.
Yeah.
Believe me, I've like gone to Palace, gotten a small wonton mein, and then gone to Helena's for pee pee call on point. I've done that before many times. You know? Yeah. So we're lucky, you know, it's close.
How would you describe so you're a chef, so you probably have a better idea, but the flavor profile of like Palace Simon, because I've never eaten Palace Simon. I've only been like Hamura's for like my whole life. Like, what do you think are the core components of that? Like, specifically the soup. Is it like a pork soup?
They do the ebi and katsuobushi.
Oh, okay.
And it's clean. It's not shrimpy. But it's not, you know, they steep it for the right amount of time. So it's not, you know, one flavor is not overpowering.
Mm.
I think at the end of the day, like with any dish, you want it to have balance. And what I get out of Palestine Man is like, I can taste everything. And everything works. So to me, that's both important in a good dish and also what draws me back.
Is any kind of bones common in Simon too? Do you know that? Like, because in ramen, it's always pork bone, chicken bones.
Right. I know, who was it? Is it Shige's that does it with chicken bones? They make like a chicken broth. I can't remember where I had it. I had it at another Simon shop. But it is definitely not the majority. The most places I know is that sort of katsuobushi or dried ebi sort of flavor profile.
Okay. Good to know. I really want to try make one assignment video or something, and but I've only had Hamura. So it's like, I think Hamura's uses some kind of bones too. That's why.
But I haven't. You know who did one with bones, and it was a cool demo. But if you look at Eater,
and Sheldon did one. Yeah,
you saw Sheldon's one.
Yeah.
You know, it works. It comes out good and it's tasty.
Where do you think the line is for the? Where does it cross over from Simon to ramen? Do you think there's a line or is it kind of,
you know,
like
I was thinking about that. I wanted to ask you what you thought that definition was.
Yeah.
I ask myself that too, because when I make my Simon dashi at home, I add a little bit of pork extract, you know, which is all of a sudden, you know, it's, and now we're starting to lean a little more towards like a tonkotsu, right?
Yeah,
sort of
yeah.
flavor profile. To me, Simon, and then if I were to say, well, Simon to me is clear soup with, you know, four or less garnishes, that could very well be ramen as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if characteristics of Simon is just that, you know, dried ebi, katsuobushi sort of broth with a slightly thicker noodle, definitely not a thinner noodle like ramen.
It's something that I've been struggling with too. Like, where does it? I know that in ramen we usually add like oil directly into the soup. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know if Simon is if that's common. You dump like 2 tablespoons of oil or 1 tablespoon of oil.
I never have.
Yeah.
And that's another one. You don't get goma. There's no goma bura.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You don't have sesame oil in it in most Simons. Come to think about it, and even when you dip your wonton, right? It's just shoyu and hot mustard.
Yeah.
So that's a good characteristic.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I got to go maybe do some research on this because I want to get it right, but I also want to figure out how to do something that's more ramen relatable too. But
because even on the table, right, there's like black pepper, there's shoyu, Tabasco, usually.
Yeah.
You don't have the rayu on the table like you do in a ramen.
Yeah. It's just
not what we grew up with, yeah?
Kwai is like chili pepper water. That's like the
chili
standard.
Chili pepper water, yeah. With you ever took your Terry burger and dipped it in your Simon?
No, never tried.
That's fucking good.
Maybe that's where the oil come from. The Terry Burger oil coming. Add that. All right. Yeah, I'm going to try. I might hit you up for more tips, but I should help hit up Sheldon too. I've never talked to him in person or online or anything, but you know, I've been a fan.
Yeah, I can connect you guys.
Oh yeah, that'll be nuts. Sheldon, sure. For people who are listening, he was on Top Chef, right? Was it Top Chef?
He is Hawaii's face.
Yeah, yeah. Now, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's kind of like the guy. He's the Sheldon guy. Simeon. He's on. Was it Top Chef? Which show was it? There's so many of these cooking shows.
He was on Top Chef. I forgot what season it was, and he came away in third place. You know, he's gone back for a couple of reunions. He's always a fan favorite.
Yeah.
He's a Hilo boy. Now now on Maui with his Ohana. Shouting, you can't miss Shouting in Top Chef. He's the one that wore the big orange, the fluorescent orange beanie. Really humble, you know, good guy. I love his food. If you're in Maui and you gotta go to Tin Roof for lunch, you know, curbside takeaway only now, but you know, oh, Ryan, the dry man. His dry man is amazing.
I got to try.
Yeah, his dry man is amazing. Yeah. But dry man has sesame. Dry man is you finish a goma abura. Yeah.
Okay, I think that's pretty good. I think this is a good one, bro. I know you got your kids. You got to cook dinner and stuff. So I don't want to take up too much more of your time. But
no, so I appreciate much. It. You know, I love how, you know, it was a, we did a show for Where Ramen, and we actually only talked about 25% about the
noodles. That's what I planned, you know. Like, I was writing out the questions, like, actually, like, ask him all these other questions about family and
success
and things. Because, you know, I talk to lots of people about making ramen, and I think for people, there's a lot of young chefs that are coming up on the mainland trying to do ramen as their thing. And the icons that we have to look at in ramen is like Ivan Orkin. There's like this, you know, Keizo. Even you've worked with Keizo before, you know. And Keizo did work in Japan, and we know a bunch of these Japanese ramen legends like Sano-san, Shimazaki-san, Yamagishi, like all these like legends. Everyone, Shono-san, but it's like there's more. I feel like with you, like I see just from the outside looking in, like your family and your life. And that's what I would consider successful more than anything. It's like you're happy. You guys seem real happy when I look at you guys from the outside looking in. And so,
we are happy. We are definitely happy most of the time.
Yeah.
Because both Amanda and I are high energy people, when we're mad at each other, we're also really mad at each other. but our life is definitely filled with a lot of joy.
Yeah.
Because of each other, our kids. You know, our community that believes in us. Lucky.
Yeah. So I just wanted to kind of like talk to you about that. Because I'm sure there's chefs out there, ramen chefs out there, people that are working in ramen shops around the country who are thinking like me.
Oh, right. Wait, hold on. Right. Before you ask your question, have you ever eaten at Sujita in Waikiki before they closed?
No. What is that?
So Sujita, LA. Well, there's one in Japan, then one to LA.
Oh, it's like a ramen shop?
They're known for their tsukimen. But you talk about like, you know, like dedicated ramen chefs, and their executive chef is a woman from Japan. Oh, it was so good. I missed it. I knew they were going to close just because they were so niche and they're in the corner of Waikiki. Yeah. Oh, I love tsukimen.
Yeah, tsukimen's good. Yeah, it's hard to make a go even in Japan. Like ramen shops, like 9 out of 10 close every year.
So. Yeah.
Kind of the constant turnover.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No worries. We're wrapping up anyway, so it's been really good. And
but you wanted to ask me about family or with chefs or something?
No. I just wanted to just bring you on, and I didn't mind not talking about ramen or Simon with you, because I feel like, you know, I wanted to show these young, like a lot of young chefs, like there's levels to this game, and you know, it's not about owning 10 restaurants or 50 restaurants. It's about being happy. It's so important, and doing stuff that you love and cooking the food that you want to cook, which is what I see you doing all the time. So it's really appreciated.
But I think that sort of time frame, that sort of timeline, the professional timeline, I think it's important to talk to young cooks and also instill the fact that you cannot forget, you cannot get to here without having gone through all of that.
Right? Yeah.
Like you said it earlier, you got to make your bones, you got to pay your dues, you have to apply yourself in the most traditional of it. You know, mm-hmm. I remember it, Alan Wong telling me one time about how he was really proud of us as a young generation of chefs. And he goes, but you know, you guys are missing something. I'm like, oh, what are we missing? He said, you know, a lot of you guys are missing the basics. And, you know, at first, you know, the younger person, he was like, what are you talking about? But then he was right in the sense that we're in a time and a place where things move so fast that how many young cooks are going to make a cassoulet or learn how to slaughter a chicken start to finish, right? Or understand what dépouillage is, or, you know, or a cartouche, or, you know, mirepoix, things like that, right? You know, things that I've seen, like ramen tatsuya, the tatsuya boys, you know, I've seen their ramen incorporated with very classical, you know, cooking techniques that are not traditional Japanese, but those boys, they made their bones, you know, they knew the basics, and then they could change it. So you gotta, you know, for you guys out there, like, a recipe is just a guideline, just like life is just a guideline, but you gotta know your basics before you start to change it.
For sure. Yeah, that's kind of something that just me personally is, I'm not a chef, I'm just like a home cook kind of thing, but trying to find, going through the process of discovering like your own palate and cooking to that, having the confidence to cook to that is kind of like, that's something I feel like, you know, when I watch your videos and stuff, it's like, man, he's cooking with all this kind of like local things, and it takes a lot of courage to do that, to not just do what everybody else is doing, you know, so give you props.
Yeah, but if you believe it, you know, if you follow your na'au, mahalo. Appreciate it.
Right on. So we can just wrap up here. So Gooch has a series called Simon Says. I saw it on the internet. Yeah, Sippy's put it up, I think.
Yeah, Hawaiian Airlines and Sippy's, yeah.
Hawaiian Airlines put it up. So
thanks, you guys.
All the videos are up there, and then do you want to hit you up on Instagram?
Yeah, Musubi Man, MUSUBMAN. Simon Says got greenlit for season 2.
Oh, serious?
Check it out.
Yeah. Maybe you should cook some Simon in the next season or something.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Let's go visit you.
Oh, shit. That's kind of shame.
Better watch out, Ryan.
All right, man. Have a good one. Take care, family. Say hi to everybody for me.
Mahalo much. Appreciate it.
All right. See you. Thanks so much again to Chef Gooch for coming on the show. It's always super cool to watch someone from afar for so long and then finally meet them, and then they're basically exactly what you hoped they would be. It was really cool. You can watch his show, Simon Says, on the Zippy's website, actually. They uploaded all the episodes of season 1, so I'll put a link for that in the show notes. And you can follow Gooch on Instagram at Musubi Man, so it's spelled MUSBMAN. As always, you can follow me on Instagram at Way of Ramen. And if you enjoy this podcast, you can support the show on anchor.fm/Way of Ramen. Over on our Discord server, we're currently running a Cook Your Culture /Cultural Appreciation Ramen Cook-Off contest. The last contest we did was a Shetty Ramen Cook-Off, and that was hilarious and a ton of fun. So the replay for that contest is also on the Discord server. But if you don't want to make Shetty Ramen and you want to give an honest to God try of making something cultural or ethnic, please enter our contest. It's free to enter. We're going to have some prizes. It's going to be good fun. We're going to run through the month of June, and judging will be sometime in early July. So the link for that will be in the show notes. As always, you can check out my YouTube channel by searching The Way of Ramen, and you'll see me try to figure out how to make ramen here in Hawaii. Thank you guys all so much for the support, and thank you for listening. I really do appreciate it. I hope you're all staying safe and healthy, and I'll see you all in the next episode. Aloha.